Welcome to Working Title Podcast. I'm your host, Joshua Paul Kane. Episode 21 is about the collaboration of indie authors and their book designers. With me today is a pair of aces, author Mark Slaughter, who wrote The Diary of a Novice Investor, The Bullet Train to Wealth Left When, and designer Sarah LaPallo of Inkwell Book Co. Their kitchen sink project encompassed just about everything one could think of: an engaging cover, colorful chapter illustrations, varied typesetting, and even tables of data. We'll discuss lessons learned, what indies should ask their designers, and what designers offer for typical fiction projects. Enjoy! Well, welcome, Mark and Sarah. Thanks for joining me on the podcast. And I would appreciate if each of you would just introduce yourselves to our listeners. So I'll start with Mark.
Hi, Josh. Thanks. Glad to be here. Glad to be here with Sarah. I think this is great. For the listeners, my name is Mark Slaughter. I've written a book called The Diary of a Novice Investor, The Bullet Train to Wealth Left When. And it stems from a desire to understand better how to take care of mom and dad. And I thought, with my background, I've spent a career dealing with money, I thought I was prepared for that, and it turns out I wasn't as prepared as I thought I was. So that's a little bit of my background. I've spent many years dealing with disaster response and recovery and flooding, and seeing how people are unable to respond to that sort of thing because we really don't prepare sufficiently for that. So it was It's all fed quite well into trying to pull this together into a viable story.
All right. Thank you. And Sarah?
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me. I'm a graphic designer. My background is in graphic design, and so I started my company, Inkwell Book Co., to help authors just like Mark to produce their books. And my company does especially well with authors like Mark, who his book has a lot of elements, and he wasn't going to be able to just drop it into some kind of template and call it a day. There's a very complicated design process for the interior, and then I worked with his illustrator to design his cover. I love what I do. I love helping authors tell their story. I love helping them with essentially the sales pitch of their cover, because that's what a cover is. It's a sales pitch. And it's really a passion of mine to help people tell their stories.
Well, great. Well, I definitely want to hear the whole story from beginning to end, because I think indie publishing is challenging but exciting for the author, and there's a lot of ways you can do every step of the way. I mean, you know, you talk to one person, they might tell you one thing, and the next person tells you another thing. So I feel it's best to maybe go with examples. So that's why I invited the two of you. So, Mark, I thought you touched on the background of your book. Would you elaborate a little bit, like why you decided to do the book? Was it always your intention to publish yourself, or was it did you want to go traditional route first? So what do you think?
You know, it was interesting. I never really set out to write the book in the first place. It evolved, and I think many of us find ourselves in that situation where we're working on a project and it evolves to something else. It just grows. And the reason I got to the point of writing the book was my parents were up in age. My father had passed away. Mom was in full-blown dementia. And, you know, my sister and I, Dad was unwilling to really discuss his finances. And so at that point, it took a lot of effort to dig around to find out where stuff was. And with their investments in stocks and bonds and mutual funds, like many people have, it took a while to wade through that. And I wanted to – it really comes down to doing right by your parents. And in order for me to do that – in my own mind, I really needed to understand what she had, and it had been many years since I had actively engaged in investing. I had a retirement plan, which many people do. Not everybody, but many people have a retirement plan through work, and it was there. I didn't really pay attention to it. It just kind of lived its own life. And I thought the best way to do this was to create a fantasy portfolio using real stocks, and follow this on a day-to-day basis, trying to make my own decisions. And it evolved into the book, which is, in essence, a comparison of what I'm trying to learn. And I used, for example purposes, as a control, investments that my mom had. And it started out literally as a diary.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually evolved with the help of local editors, Zula Consulting. It evolved into what it is, which is much better than where I started. And this was one of the reasons that Sarah and I got together. She said, you know, there's some interesting elements in the book. And one of the things that I feel strongly about, particularly in Richmond, we have some great resources. There are a lot of folks that do graphics, do design work, do illustrations. We've got, you know, authors of all types. And I really felt strongly about connecting with local people. And that's how I came across Sarah. I think Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think somehow we had connected on social media, and that evolved into a working relationship. And that was great.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we connected on LinkedIn or something. I think we talked a little bit there. We talked about your project and realized it was going to be a good fit, and went from there.
Oh, that's interesting. So you might have met through LinkedIn, which I don't think is something many people would consider for this kind of project. I think they would like look through Twitter or Facebook perhaps first. That's interesting.
It's interesting for me, Josh. You know, many, many years ago when I first got into LinkedIn, and for listeners, you know, I started this project. Dad passed away in 2012, and so I really started the project in 2013. And in the back of my mind, I always had a desire to connect with folks in the Richmond area. And so I had sort of been mining LinkedIn, if you will, and other social media to make those connections, thinking in my mind at some point I may have a reason to, you know, reach out to one of these folks. And that's what it turned out with both Zula Consulting and Sarah, as well as Douglas Fuchs, who did the illustrations. He was a VCU student at the time. And, you know, Sarah can talk about the different book elements, the illustrations, the tables, and all that. It took a lot of effort for her to really be able to pull that all together into a format that worked and flowed.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, go ahead, Sarah. I didn't mean to cut it.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, no problem. Just a lot of organization, too, and a lot of back and forth between Mark and I on what was really important. I don't think we ended up getting rid of any of the elements that he had, but he had so many.
Mm-hmm.
We had to figure out what the hierarchy of each of the elements was in terms of sections and subsections and different elements within those. And at the same time, we were trying to give the book kind of a humorous spin, because the writing is very humorous and very conversational, and the design had to reflect that. So it was basically just like a year-long conversation about what this should look like, how it should function.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, it was a huge project, one of the bigger ones I think I've taken on.
Well, I definitely want to get into that more, but just real quick, Mark, was it humor comes through it from the cover to the back cover. Was that always something you thought would be an element of the book, or did you start off more like it was a straight-laced kind of information?
When I first started this, as I said, I really started this writing a daily diary, which got modified into more of a weekly diary. And at the time, I was working on another project that has to deal with creating illustrations and, you know, witty or sarcastic or pithy phrases to go with them. And so those two projects kind of melded together. And some of the things that are in the book, if you start to involve yourself in learning about investing, and, you know, typically nowadays people will sign up for, you know, e-letters and different email lists. And at some point you learn that, you know, some of this is really just farcical. You know, they're really pushing the market to you. I mean, there's one that I see constantly that asks, you know, if you have a $500,000 portfolio, you should do this. And in my mind, I'm thinking to myself, you know, how many people have $500,000?
Right.
So, you know, it kind of evolved. There was always an current of desire to provide some humor, because quite frankly, investing,
it's a nice problem to have. What do I do with my $500,000 that I have lying around?
Yes, just, you know, would that we all were so fortunate. So it was there. It wasn't floating on the top, but it was underneath, and eventually became more prevalent in the book, and that was also with working with Sarah. Mm-hmm. She picked up on some of that and said, you know, look, what if you did this, and this? What if you altered this? Can you go do this? And having that back and forth is really important, particularly in something like this when you have so many different elements of the book.
Right. Was it important that it be a printed book rather than just an e-book? Many indie authors might start with just an e-book because it's quicker turnaround and it's more affordable for an indie author. You know, I would expect in many cases, maybe not in your case, but was it important to you to have a printed version?
You know, and I'll just have to be forthright in this. There's sort of the ego gets involved in this too. It's ego in a good way, because you spend time, you work on this project, and it's your baby. You want to bring it to fruition. And so there's a little bit of ego in getting a printed version of this. But, and I can let Sarah speak to this in more detail, but trying to do an ebook version of this, is really complicated.
Yeah, we looked into it, and we talked about it for a long time. And basically, the difference between an ebook and a print book, an ebook is really more like a website than a book, because it's coded rather than laid out. And Mark's book has so many elements. It wasn't one that was going to just easily convert to an ebook. It was going to be a long process and a complicated process, especially to make sure that it worked across multiple platforms, you know, works on a Nook and an iPad and whatever. It was just going to get really expensive. And people just don't expect to pay a whole lot for ebooks. And it kind of just didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense for it to become an ebook in the traditional sense. And it made more sense to sell digital copies as just a PDF straight up.
Right. But, and the elements you mentioned, I imagine, would be the illustrations, tables. I'm sure tables are very difficult to get right on across the different platforms.
Yeah, definitely. He also had quotes, diary entries, emails, articles, the artwork, like I said, sections, subsections, cards, lists.
Yeah, there's probably, I don't know, Sarah, what do you think, maybe somewhere between 15 to 20 different elements when you start thinking about, you know, the bullets and the lists and the tables and everything that goes into it.
This seems like it covers, like, is there any kind of book you could do that this didn't have an element in?
I can't think of anything that's missing.
You know, it's kind of interesting, Josh. I, you know, Sarah said it was a complicated process, and you know, for folks who are considering writing a book, I knew based on some beta reader feedback, I knew what I had in hand, and the format that I started with was not saleable in any way, shape, or form. And so when I was looking for editors, and this is why I selected Zula Consulting, is because they come from a financial background, the women that own that company. Mm-hmm. And I needed somebody to work with that didn't, you know, they didn't necessarily have to understand stocks and mutual funds, but they needed to work in the realm of financial language, which is what they do. And so I knew going into it that it wasn't going to be easy and it wasn't going to be pretty. And for folks who are thinking about writing a book, here is the way I approach this. I'm going to pay somebody a lot of money to tell me that what I've put together is crap.
Yeah.
And to a large degree, that's kind of what happened. But that was an expectation. I was willing to accept that because in my mind, if I wasn't going to be open-minded with an editor, then the product that would have come out the other side would not have been the best that it could be. And I had that same perspective with Sarah, which is why we spent a lot of time going back and forth talking about the design and the layout and the flow.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear that because I think everyone needs an editor. So were you satisfied with your working with the company to do the editing? Did they give you a lot of valuable feedback?
In essence, it was a really interesting from a process standpoint. Again, you know, I had literally diary entries and, mm-hmm. and they came back to me and said, this is not going to work. You need to go do this. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting is it took me about 4 months to figure out how I could do what they were telling me, because it was really 180 degrees from what I had done and what was resonant in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a long time for me to reform the whole concept in my own head before I could put that into practice and put what they wanted to paper, how to reformat it, how to restructure it. It was in many ways a complete rewrite. It was a little bit weird because by the time I had finished the book and was working with them, I had also decided one of the mantras in investing is you look for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And my book covers a 12-month period, and I got to the end of that, and I thought to myself, you know, if I'm trying to convey to folks this long-term view that we need to have to be financially successful through investing, mm-hmm. I should probably create a longer-term example. And so I was in the process of writing, if you will, the second volume of this while trying to edit the first one. And that rolled over into, because the second one covered a 6-month period, and I decided I was going to write a third one, which would cover another 6-month period. So in total, if I ever get all this done as a sort of trilogy, if you will, it will cover real time, 2-year period. And so at one point I was working on all 3 books at once. So it really got confusing. But the advantage to that was in working with the editors and working with Sarah while I was going through the first one, even though I was working on the second one. Once I understood what they were telling me and I understood the direction I needed to go, I was able to take that information and immediately apply it. I went back and revised the second one and started to format the third one based on their guidance.
Mm.
So it was a huge benefit to having access to both the editors and to Sarah to, you know, provide that input.
Well, I think it's a credit to you. You were willing to do that because others might have just balked. Either they said, you're crazy, I'm going to stick with this and go with maybe an inferior version. Instead of actually doing the work that, you know, I guess it's hard to always judge, you know, who's right. You know, sometimes it's just a matter of taste.
Well, and there is a give and take. I think Sarah would agree with me on this. There were a lot of things. I would say most of our conversations, we agreed. We'd go back and forth on ideas, and we would agree. And there really weren't that many things that we truly disagreed with. I mean, Sarah, I can only think of a few things off the top of my head where it took a little bit more effort on our part to converse the resolution versus this is what would make the most sense. And it was, okay, that makes the most sense. Let's go do this.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And that's one of the cool things about working on a team is Mark is coming at it from his perspective, which is, this is my story, this is what I know, this is what I'm trying to convey. And I'm coming at it from my perspective, which is, here are the aesthetics that I think would work, here's how I can help you convey your message, here are my ideas. And the really cool thing is when we meet in the middle, mm-hmm. and we come up with something that neither one of us would have come up with on our own. I think Mark's book is an incredible example of that compromise and coming up with something greater than ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting too, Josh. One of the things, kind of going back to your somewhat related to your earlier question about, was humor always intended? I had a lot of books as a kid, and my parents, my dad still had a lot of his books that he had as a kid, and even from his mother. And, I have really fond memories of books that are illustrated. And some of the illustrations, truly just pieces of artwork. And so there was that desire in me also to, if I'm going to write a book, by golly, I'm going to have illustrations. That's what I want. it's kind of interesting that played into it also.
And that's the freedom of being an indie author, is you can make those decisions and not have it vetoed by anybody.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. Investing is a very, very dry subject, and in many ways, talking about investing in public is a little bit like talking politics and religion. People in many ways don't do it. And in my research, we're experiential learners. We learn to ride a bike because somebody teaches us. We learn to drive a car because somebody teaches us. We learn to operate a piece of machinery because somebody teaches us. We learn, there's an example I use in the book about, many people that I know is that at some point in your life, you see a candle and you put your hand over the candle flame because you want to understand the relationship between the flame, heat, and pain. It's a weird species thing. But most people I know have done that. And even if you're a 5-year-old and mom or dad says, don't do it, as soon as they leave the room, what happens? you go over, you creep over, make sure they're not looking, and you put your hand over that flame. And the advantage is that they told you beforehand what would happen. So you had that foreknowledge. And I did not find any books on the market for investing that were experiential in that way. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people will do 50, 60 pamphlets and call themselves an author, and they throw it up on Amazon or someplace, and, offer it up for 50 cents and make this claim to being an author and a financial guru. But most of the books are either theoretical or very specific in the sense of, this is how the stock market works. And these are different techniques that you can use for investing, and this is what works for technique A or technique B, and here's why you want to do it. But nobody talks about the personal side of it. And there are people who write psychology books on investing. But, you know, you or I or Sarah are not going to go pick up a psych book to explain to me, you know, my why I'm behaving in a particular way when it comes to investing, any more than I would do that if I was going to go out to Las Vegas and, you know, sit at the blackjack table. I'm not going to read a book beforehand telling me what my emotions are going to be, or the psychology behind my decision making. And so I still feel that this fills a void in the investing information field so that people can understand the types of things that they're likely to experience, why it may or may not be important. And I'm pretty open in the book with regard to making good decisions and bad decisions.
Right, you're open. You're not trying to hide the mistakes.
Absolutely. And that was also one of the good things about having Sarah on board and editors is, you know, you get that outside critique that they then can come to you and say, I really don't know what you're saying here, or, you know, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense the way you're explaining it. Can you explain it in a different way? Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, that's another reason, as Sarah said, it's another reason to try to collaborate in a team context, because you do come out the other side with a much better product.
Okay. One more question, then I want to go to Sarah's perspective on all this. So you had you had your first book finished. You're having it edited. At what point does the illustrations come in? Did you have that ready before you reached out to Sarah, or was that during the process with Sarah?
I had everything in place before, because it didn't make a whole lot of sense for me to give Sarah a half-finished product, because mm-hmm. I knew there were other elements that she was going to have to work with. And even to the point where I had the illustrations done so that the editors could see them also. I had all the component pieces in place, and with the editors and Sarah's expertise, you know, they really, really helped tie it all together.
Okay, great. And Sarah, when any client comes to you, that first interaction with a client, what questions do you ask, and how can an author best be prepared for the questions and to hit the ground running should you both choose to go forward with the project?
Well, typically the conversation goes like this. Someone calls me and they say, hey, I have a book. This is the basic idea of my book. Is this something you can help me with? And usually my answer is yes. And then at that point, they usually spend some time telling me about their book. And what they're telling me is, you know, so I wrote so many words, it's so many chapters, I was inspired by such and such, and I'm sort of trying to write it in the tone of so-and-so, and kind of my idea is that I'm going to market it to this type of person. And that's kind of about as far as I've got. What I'm listening for is not so much their specifics, because at this stage of the game, it doesn't matter how many words they have. It doesn't even really matter what the book is about. What I'm listening for is their tone. And by tone, I don't mean, you know, tone like you think of voice. I'm looking for how they talk, who they are, what they're like. And I'm getting ideas for how that's going to translate into design. I'm also listening to hear the specific elements that they talk about that they tend to repeat, sometimes specific elements. And that tells me that those elements are important. Maybe those elements need to belong on the cover in some way.
Okay.
I find it really challenging to design for somebody that I haven't spoken with, even if it's just on the phone. I find it really challenging to design for someone because I feel like I don't really know them and I don't know their project the way they know it. Mm-hmm. I can read the book, and I usually do. I can speed read the books and get the gist of it and get a sense of their writing tone and the elements and It's about a woman, so maybe we put a woman on the cover. But it's really helpful for me to just talk to my authors and just learn about them and their story, their passion. And that's all information that influences and educates my design. And that to me is really important, because even though this person has spent months or years, sometimes decades, writing 20, 30, 100,000 words, it's still my job to be the initial salesman for the book. When the cover is lying there on a table or it's on a bookshelf, my work is the very first thing that a potential buyer sees. And I take that very seriously, because it's sort of the backbone of my business, that I can't help you with any marketing. That's not what I do. But I'm going to help you design a cover that will be your salesman.
Right. No, I think that's a great analogy, is a salesman, that the cover is a salesman.
And because of that, it puts a big responsibility on the cover. It's not just a pretty image and some type. It's got a really big job to do. And it takes a lot of time to get there, and a lot of effort, and a lot of myself goes into that as well. And then from there, we can take the elements of the cover to design the interior of the book. And designing the interior of the book is actually a real pleasure for me, because that's a place where we can have a little bit of fun. The prospective buyer is already a buyer. They're already reading them. They're already sold. So at this point, we just want to give them a great experience. It's the difference between staying in a motel and staying in a 5-star suite. We're trying to set the mood, set the tone, you know, have some fun with it, and put out a product that's unique and interesting and art, visually interesting. Because reading a book is such a cool experience, and why not make it fun?
Well, I agree with that, especially when you have a book that's humorous. Well, let's go through the book. So we'll start with the cover. Just in general, you do covers. Are there certain genres lend themselves to certain covers, for example? How do you know? You know, you're getting feedback from the client itself, but him or herself, I should say. But there must be other inputs, right? What's out on the market now, perhaps, and the genre it's in, and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes I'll use the genre of a book to, you know, you can pull certain elements from a genre. Like horror is an easy one. You're going for dark and moody and angular, crazy type. And sometimes you want to fit into that genre exactly. Sometimes you want to stand out from the genre. Mm. What I like to do is I like to spend a little bit of time doing what's called visual research. So looking at other book covers that are similar within the same genre, so that I can get a sense of what people are expecting, but also what's been done. Because I want to do a cover that's going to fit in, but also stand out.
Well, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, it's really easy to get caught up in the middle there, because those two things don't necessarily go together, but...
I think, like, for the romance genre, for example, we all would envision, you know, a couple on the cover, for example, you know, maybe one's bare-chested, you know, and there's, you know, wind in through the hair kind of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. But then to get more specific, it's usually romance novel covers are usually photographs or hyper-realist rather than illustrative.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe one way that my book cover can stand out is that it's illustrative instead of photographic. Or maybe the color scheme is very different. Maybe instead of those you know, bright sunset type colors. Maybe it's all pastels. So if you're, and usually the storyline dictates these types of decisions.
Mm-hmm. And on the back cover, Mark, did you write the copy there, or Sarah, did you do that?
I think we collaborated on it.
Okay, great.
Yeah, basically, excuse me, I had worked with my illustrator for the, I wanted something that would look like a stock certificate. And in the old days, if you will, when you bought stock, you actually got a piece of paper. And some of those are very artistic. You can get on the internet and do a search of old stock certificates. So I wanted something that would be reflective of a stock certificate. And while doing that, Sarah comes back and says, look, you got to have something on the back.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just do this. You know, you have to have some text. You can't just leave people hanging. and so I said, okay, you know, fine, that makes sense. And we went back and forth through, a handful of versions of the text in the back and, different designs of, or I should say rather different layouts on the back cover. And even on the front cover, you know, Sarah said she starts with the front cover. And I can tell your listeners that this front cover is not the one that we started with.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, we went quite a bit.
Yeah, and it was interesting from my perspective to watch Sarah work. You know, I had a front cover that I had Doug do. Yeah, and so Sarah took that, played around with it, came up with a variation on that. We went back and forth a little bit on that and came up with the current cover. And what's interesting, as she was saying, is, you know, you can take elements that are within the book, apply them to the cover, but the reverse is true also. So if you look at, like, the typeface, the colors, not necessarily the font, but you, and maybe it's easier for me to see it because I watched Sarah do all this, but she wove some of the cover elements into the book itself. So that was really neat to see that come to life.
I agree, yeah. Sarah, it looks like you and Mark had a great time with the interior. I mean, from the first page to the last, you've got different colors to indicate, I guess, different types of information. You've got the chapters that begin with an illustration. And then you've got the charts. So how did that all come together? And how long did it take?
I was trying to remember how long this took, and I really don't remember. It was a while. I think it was at least a year.
Yeah.
And part of that time, too, Mark would go back to the drawing board for a while. You know, for example, I'll come back and I'll say, all right, Mark, really need some back cover text. Okay. And then it takes a week or two, and he works on that and sends it back, you know, so there's some waiting periods during there. But it was a long process, and it was very detailed. Like I said before, organization on this one was key. One of the things that I had to do was, I don't think I ever showed you this, Mark, but you'd probably be interested to see it at some point. I have a Word document and a table with a set of rules. So, if like under the emails section, like Mark has emails, woven into his book. There were rules like, the lines have to go in this order. You know, the information at the top, subject, header, the date, who it's from, who it's to, they have to go in a certain order. And then we're going to indent emails, but we're not going to indent the first line. We're only going to indent paragraphs after that. You know, so there's a whole list of all these rules. I just couldn't keep it all straight in my mind. There were too many of them. Mark was keeping up fine. So basically, I would just go through the book very slowly, and I did this dozens of times, page by page, section by section, checking the rules as I'm going, mm-hmm. making sure I'm following all of my own rules. Oh. Otherwise, the design starts to become very cluttered, it starts to feel very random, and it starts to get... Because it has to be intuitive. It has to be, when you're looking at what's supposed to be an email, for example, has to immediately read as an email. You don't want your reader to sit there and have to figure out what they're looking at and then read it and then digest it. Just making them work harder than they have to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to help visually guide readers through the book so that they don't have to struggle with the visuals. They don't have to struggle with the layout. They can just take in the information, take in what Mark is saying, learn from it, laugh along with it, and move on.
Mm-hmm. Right. You don't want to get in the way of the reading. You want to help facilitate it.
Yeah, exactly. You want to enhance it.
Right.
And some of that work, Josh, mm-hmm. you know, some of what Sarah was going through to you know, keep all that format and layout to make sure that it flowed. In certain instances, that also forced me to go back and actually look at the text and ask myself, okay, is there something I need to do here from an editing standpoint? And, mm-hmm. and I think there were several spots where things were edited because of what Sarah was trying to accomplish. And again, going into this, you know, that was something I had accepted before all of this started anyway, that I was going to be told that what was here needed to be changed. And I think that's really important for anybody who's writing a book to understand that, you know, your first draft or your tenth draft is not going to be the last one, because when someone else reads it, they're going to come back and tell you to change it. And we, I think, as authors and writers, we, to a certain degree, have to be willing to accept that. And I saw the same thing in the book design process. So that, to me, also was a real benefit. Because here's Sarah, you know, she's working to try to make this a really good product, and it's forcing me to do things better. And that's ultimately really, I think, what we're all after as writers, doing the best that we can.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I always like to tell my authors, too, is that the process of producing your book is going to be a lot harder than you think. Writing it is one step. Producing it is the next step. Marketing it is the third step. And the phase of production it can be long. You've got the editing, you've got the design, and it can be kind of agonizing for some people and exhilarating for others, but a piece of advice that I give all my authors, whether or not I work with them, is if you can afford it, hire people to help you with your book.
Mm-hmm.
Hire people to do the editing. Hire people to do the design. Trust them because they are professionals, but also listen to your instincts and keep your core message at heart. You don't want to lose yourself or your voice in this process. And, you know, be willing to stand up for yourself and to fight for what you think is right, but also listen to what they have to say.
Mm-hmm. You know, Josh, one of the things that I've told folks who have asked me about the book and getting editors, as I've said, look, you know, I went and paid people to tell them what I did was bad. You know, I mean, you know, to a large degree that there's a lot of truth to that. I paid someone to tell me this is not good. But Sarah's exactly right that in order to do a project like this, and even if you don't have all the elements that this book has, you want someone who has the expertise. You want someone that can bring a fresh set of eyes and really does this sort of work for a living, you know, and that's what you want. You hire the expertise.
Yep. Yep. Just generally, Sarah, can you say how much a typical, let's say, fiction book would cost? Or put another way, what are the biggest factors that drive the cost up when working with a book designer?
Well, it's usually going to be a set of flat rates. So some flat rates and some variable rates. So usually the cost to design a cover is pretty flat, anywhere from $300 to $800.
Okay.
And nowhere in that range is remotely unreasonable. And then there's the cost of your artwork. So in Mark's case, he created custom artwork. And if you can afford it, that is absolutely the way you should go. can't afford it, you want to go with stock artwork, that's fine too. We can always make some adjustments to it to make it a little bit different. And the cost of stock artwork and custom artwork is just going to range very, very widely, anywhere from $10,000 to $3,000. Obviously, custom artwork with somebody with an incredible reputation is going to cost you on that higher end. And then the interior is usually a flat rate for doing the design of the interior, and then the variable rates are usually word count, page count, chapter count. Everybody does it differently. Mm-hmm. I do it by word count and by chapter count because, a 20,000 word book versus a 150,000 word book, it's just obviously one's going to take a lot longer than the other. And then to the same effect, some people do really short chapters, and chapters are the thing that give me more time to design. So because I'm laying them out individually, I program a lot of it, but still have to go through and see what's what and click on it and make sure it's right. And that's usually how I price things out. So if you're an indie author and you're trying to hire a designer to do your cover and your interior, depending on what you're able to provide them and who you hire, the whole thing is probably going to range anywhere from $500 to maybe $4,000 or $5,000.
Oh yeah! And, wow.
And anywhere in that range is there. Then some books can cost more than that easily, and again, that's fair. I mean, if you think about graphic designers are sometimes very intimidated by designing books because typically we're designing a brochure or a business photo or a poster. And a book is like 500 posters in a row, you know? and so it can be very intimidating, and it's a very laborious process, and it's a very detailed process, and a good designer is going to take their time on it. They're going to do it right. They're going to check the details. They're going to ask questions that you didn't think to ask. They're gonna probe. They're gonna help you try to come up with this product that's as good as it can be. And it's a long, complicated experience.
Mm-hmm. What about typically, at least for you? I'm sure each designer has their own way of doing it, but when you sign on with a client, how many shots do they get with you as far as a design? Let's say, like the typesetting, maybe you choose a font and they don't like that font. How much back and forth do you get with the client before it starts to get exorbitant for the client?
this is one thing I do that I think is different from some of my competitors. Oftentimes the process is defined as we're going to come up with so many versions. You can choose the ones you like. We'll go through so many rounds of changes. And that's just not really how I work. I don't want to take your money unless you're really happy. And I just, maybe it's the perfectionist in me. I don't know. But I'm usually, to an extent, but usually happy to go back and forth as long as you need to get it right. Because I feel like if it takes me 20 tries to get it right, that's not usually the client being difficult. It's usually the client having a vision, and I'm not capturing that vision properly.
Okay.
Or I'm not capturing it in the way that they vision. Mm-hmm. And if we're going back and forth 20 times, I'm taking responsibility on that. Either I'm not really listening to what you're saying, I'm not understanding what you're saying, I'm not asking the right questions, and so I put that responsibility on myself, and we work together as a team for as long as it takes to get it right. And I've been doing this for a while now, and I have kind of a flow, mm-hmm. and it doesn't usually take me 20 tries to get it right, okay. you know. So that's why I don't like to set parameters like that, and a lot of players do, and it's not unreasonable that to set it up that way, just not the way that I work.
Mm-hmm. And for a typical work of fiction, let's say, I don't know, 80,000-90,000 word book, how long does a project like that take typically for you to turn around?
Maybe about 6 weeks.
6 weeks, okay.
Yeah, and it depends a lot on the client, because they come to me with what they think is complete, and it's usually not complete. Usually it's missing some elements, or haven't really thought through what they want their cover to be, and so there's more back and forth there. Or get them a proof, proof copy of their book for them to review, and I say, take all the time you need to review it, and sometimes they take a month to review it. So it's a little hard to set, an average, but on average, I would say typical novel with basic cover, normal interior layout, six to maybe 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the opposite end, sometimes I have these complicated, like, family history type books or a book like Marx, that just have a lot of elements that need to all come together.
Mm-hmm.
Projects like that can take a lot longer.
Okay. These are probably maybe nitty-gritty questions, but for example, do book designers such as yourself help with, like, that first page with the copyright information and stuff like that? Or does the author expected to provide that stuff? Like the disclaimer and the copyright information and stuff like that.
No, I provide that. I have a standard copyright that I use. Some authors have something specific they want to include in their copyright, and that's totally fine. Sometimes as I'm working on a book, I'll realize that it does need a disclaimer or an introduction, and I'll go back to the author and suggest those things.
Mm-hmm.
I lean on the author to write their own author bio, for example,
mm-hmm.
but I will spend a lot of time helping them edit it down or help them come up with the content that needs to be there, and that's kind of the publishing consulting side of what I do. As well as being a graphic designer. So on the one hand, I have all these elements that I can help you create, and on the other hand, I'm leaning on the author to help me create the things that they need, like my cover text, but I can offer a lot of direction as well.
Okay. And how about as far as ISBN numbers? Are they required? And if so, is it for the author to get, or is that something you provide? And what about barcodes for printed books?
Yeah, we actually do it both ways.
Okay.
Most of my authors do use my ISBNs. And the way ISBNs work is I purchase them, and I can't sell them, but I can let my authors use them. And when they use my ISBNs, technically they're published by me, by Inkwell Book Co., not, published by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So on one side we do that. On the other side, sometimes authors do want to buy their own ISBNs. You can buy them in bulk, which they're buying their own ISBNs in bulk. That's saving them a lot of money at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're published by themselves, which is how Mark did it.
Mm-hmm.
As you notice on Mark's spine, he has his own publishing logo there. He doesn't have my logo,
mm-hmm.
because he used his own ISBN and not one of mine.
I see.
And barcodes go along with that. Barcodes are, sometimes people try to sell you barcodes, but they're not that hard to generate for free. And some printers will generate them for you or include them in your template. So I don't recommend buying barcodes.
Okay, good to know.
Mm-hmm.
How about pricing? Is that something you help the author with in determining the price to sell their books? And in the case of Mark, did you guys work on that?
Yeah, we did work on that. Actually, that conversation is coming back to me. Because Mark had an idea of what he wanted to sell the book for, and I had an idea of what it was going to cost per book for him to produce, and we kind of had to meet in the middle there. Again, this goes along with the publishing consulting side of what I do. I'm not just a graphic designer, someone who knows about self-publishing, and often we'll collaborate to figure out what the price of a book needs to be. And in the case of Mark's book, we were thinking about, you know, how many pages it was, but also how much information was in there. The fact that it's an educational book and not a novel influenced our decision. And then the interior pages are printed in color, so that took our production costs up. You can also usually sell those for a little bit more. So you sort of have to figure out what that means, where you land.
Mm-hmm. What could you recommend for indie authors for coming up with a price for their book? Or any tips for, you know, I'm talking just in, you know, let's say a commercial novel.
My advice is always to check out your comp title. Check out the comparables. See what else is out there that's similar to your book. Take a look at how thick they are and what they sell for. Take a look at what the insides look like and what the covers look like. And when you find something similar, you know, as similar as possible, you can take a look at what it's priced at. And that'll give you an idea of what the market wants for that kind of book. So, you know, a big chunky book like Mark's might sell for $25, but you're not going to sell, you know, a 100-page book of poetry for that.
Right. Okay, I see. Right.
You know, it's interesting, Josh, because I decided not to do a hardbound version of this, and it's as for the very reasons that Sarah just lays out in answer to your question with doing color illustrations and everything that went into this. I think, geez, I want to say that in order to even attempt to have a profitable book, I'd have to go back and look specifically, but I want to say I was pushing $40 at a retail
price.
I was
going to say $40, that's what I remember as well.
And you know, for me, you know, I didn't think that wasn't what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so Sarah's guidance again in this regard, in the conversations that we had was very useful. And again, that's why you want to go get the expertise.
Right. I think 40 is, I think, more than a lot of people would be willing to pay for both books, you know, any kind of book.
Yeah, exactly.
That takes me back to college, you know.
Yeah, right.
And then they buy it back for 10, and then they'll sell it used for 20. So.
Right.
okay, well, good. I think that's helpful for our listeners for pricing. How about proofing? So now the book's fairly put together, and you're getting the a physical copy back in your hands. And Mark, what was that feeling like when you're actually holding the book in your hands the first time?
You can't be anything but happy. And again, you know, this was one of the things that Sarah suggested. It wasn't just the fact that I, you know, my ego wanted that tangible thing in my hands. But Sarah was very helpful in that regard too. Of, look, we've gone through this whole process. You want to order, you know, a copy of this and go through it page by page, line by line, all over again. And so I was very excited to get the book, and then I was very upset that I'd missed a couple of edits.
Well, you know, this is a little trick we learned in art school. There was this one class I was in. It was a figure drawing class, and I had to draw this guy's knee, just his knee and his leg and his foot, and I was working on the knee, and it just did not look right. And my professor suggested that I hold it up and look at it in a mirror. And when you look at it in a mirror and see it flipped, it like seeing it for the first time. Oh, and you can look at it and immediately go, oh, it's this angle here, or it's this measurement is off. And it's the exact same thing when you're working with a book. So this author has been working forever in a Word document, and I can't tell you how many authors have sworn to me up and down, there are no more typos in my book. I can't see it. And I go, okay, yeah, okay. And then I lay out the book, and I'm looking through it, and I'm thinking, gosh, I think we've got everything. I don't see any more issues. I don't see any more errors. Even just saving it as a PDF and looking at it as a PDF, I see things I didn't see before. And I send it to the author, and they're seeing it as a PDF for the first time, and they catch things, and they're like, I can't believe it. I can't believe I missed these. No, it's cool. It's how it works. They send it back to me. I make the changes. Then we order a proof, and then when they get that physical book in their hand, every single author comes back to me at some point and says, I cannot believe I missed that.
Yes, I can relate.
Yeah. And they usually kind of smack themselves in the head and go, oh, I must not have been focused enough.
Right.
And it's just the nature of it. If there was a way that you could hold your Word document up in a mirror and look at it with fresh eyes that way, you would do it, you know? Sometimes I think even just changing the font or changing the color can help you see things you didn't see before.
That should be an option in the new version of Word or PDF, you know, reverse. flips the document.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a great question. You know, that's why you want other people to read it. I think at least my experience is I have no doubt that some of the edits were missed because, you know, I wrote it. It's all in my head. And, the physical nature of eye movement over a page for words that you've written and how it gets translated in your brain, you're filling the gaps. I have no doubt that that's the reason some of the edits I missed.
I'm sure that's true. Yes, yes. Now, how did you decide to go about having it printed, you know, where to sell it, you know, those kinds of things?
You know, it was interesting. From the very beginning, I didn't think a traditional publisher would be interested in this, so I decided that I would self-publish, create my own publishing LLC to do it with. And part of that is, you know, I'd like to be able to engage others and help them through this process as well. But I pretty much always desired or had determined this would be self-published. And, you know, when you start digging around on that, most people think, great, I can do something, I'll throw it up on Amazon and sell. And then you learn, well, yes, you can, but if you're an indie publisher and you're selling, you know, if Amazon's the distributor, then you have a lot of independent bookstores, booksellers, mm-hmm. who don't want to deal with Amazon. So,
right.
You know, you've cut out a whole selection, a whole section of your market. And so I decided to go with the company Ingram Spark. That's not to give them free airplay, but I decided to do that because they provide copies to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if it's Amazon, doesn't matter if it's Barnes & Noble, it doesn't matter. So they are a known entity in the publishing industry, and anybody who is interested, for example, if there were local bookstores here in Richmond that wanted copies, they can go right to Ingram Spark and order as many as they want.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it easier on them. And I can meet their needs. You know, obviously you've got to deal with the wholesale and retail values. It does it in a way that, in many ways, it simplifies the process for me. I'm not the one having to run out and print copies and then mail them. And I'm also not the one collecting the money for payment. So for me, it just made a lot of sense for me to rely on these folks. You do the distribution. It can go anywhere on the planet. And they pay you as a distributor. They're going to take their cut of it, and whatever's left over is going to come to me. And my experience so far with them is perfect.
Hmm.
I've had absolutely no issues.
Actually, yeah, most of my authors end up going with Ingram Spark for all the reasons that Mark just said.
And it's been interesting, Josh, of, you know, every once in a while I'll get online and do a search for the book. And, I mean, I found my book listed in Australia, New Zealand, England, France.
Oh, wow.
Norway or Sweden, somewhere else in the Netherlands. It might be Denmark. I think Canada. There was an independent bookseller in California, as well as, there's four or five different, you know, country Amazons.
Mm-hmm.
That have carried it. So, you know, again, if from a distribution standpoint, that to me is one of the hardest things that we have to consider. How do you get the book out?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we really have two choices. You find a traditional publisher who will do all that. But if you're an indie publisher, you have two choices. Either you print all your copies and then you have to go stuff envelopes, pay the postage, take the time and effort to drive to the post office or FedEx or whoever to ship it, or you find somebody else to do it. So, you know, I could probably make a little bit more money if I was doing the printing and the shipping and postage all on my own. But when I start to tabulate up those costs as well as the time that it's going to take me to do all that, you know, there's really not that much of a difference. Why not just let somebody else do the heavy lifting?
Right. Makes sense.
I back up everything Mark said, 100%.
Sarah, do you help authors, if they ask, setting up accounts with Ingram Spark or whomever, Amazon and so forth, or do you leave it to them to do that?
Yeah, I absolutely do that. Again, that's the publishing consulting part of what I do.
Okay. Oh,
most of the time, I can sort of steer my authors in the right direction, and they can set up their accounts themselves. If I do it, I just have to charge them for that time, and if I can save them that money, I want to do it. But yeah.
Well, wonderful. Well, let's wrap up. How about for each of you? Last thoughts, maybe. Lessons learned or more tips that a listener might appreciate for indie publishing. Sarah, you want to start first?
Of course, yeah. I would say that the number one thing that you need to know is you need to know yourself. You need to define your goals, because you know what works for you, what your strengths are, what your goals are, how you see your business looking, all the rest of your decisions start to become really obvious. It's just the best exercise you can do is to just think about who you are and what you want, and the rest just kind of starts to fall in front of you.
Okay. And Mark?
Yeah, Josh, this has been great. Thanks, Sarah. Always good to, you know, chat with you and be with you. I think one of the biggest takeaways, and I'm going to use sort of advertising as an analogy here. You know, a client will go to a marketing company and, you know, have this grand vision of what their commercial should be like. You know, fireworks, and famous people, fast cars, Ferris wheels, airplanes, you know, whatever it may be. But then that marketing company says, okay, well, that's great. We can do whatever you want. So what's your budget? And the client comes back and says, well, I only got $5,000. So, yeah, you know, you can have this huge, wonderful vision. But if you really don't recognize your constraints, all you're going to end up doing is frustrating yourself. And that's why I said earlier, when engaging with the editors and with Sarah and also with Doug on the illustrations, you know, I had made the decision before I even contacted all these folks that it was going to be a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
There were things that we weren't going to agree on, and there were things that I was just going to have to suck it up and accept as being better than what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. And so in a nutshell, I would say you have to be open to revisions and modifications and changes. You know, I think Sarah even said it, you know, you want to be true to yourself and your vision, but don't lock yourself into it, because if you do, you're going to come out the other side, and it's just not going to be the product that it could have been.
Yeah, fair enough. And to close out, how about each of you plug? Sarah, how could people find you and Mark the same?
The best way to find me is my website. It's just inkwellbookcompany.com.
Great.
And for me, I've recently started a YouTube channel, but you can go to the website, which is Lee and Lee, and that's L-E-E and L-E-A, leeandleepublishing.com, and you will find me there and some other stuff.
Great. Well, I hope people check you out.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Josh. And Mark, it's always a pleasure when our paths cross, you guys.
Oh, likewise. Yes. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah.
Thank you, Josh.
All right. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.